I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times.
I, James F. Kenney.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support, obey, and defend.
That I will support, obey, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
The Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
And the Home Rule Charter of Philadelphia.
And the Home Rule Charter of Philadelphia.
And that I will discharge the duties of my office.
And that I will discharge the duties of my office.
With fidelity.
With fidelity.
Congratulations,
thank
Mr.
You.
Mayor.
Yesterday, Jim Kenney was sworn in for a second term as Philadelphia's mayor. The city and the mayor face serious and systemic problems. It's still the poorest big city in the country. And while there are some bright spots, many students still struggle to learn, and some schools are toxic hazard sites. The homicide rate has been rising in recent years, and the police department is in need of bold reform rocked by scandals involving harassment and abuse. Last week, Mayor Kenney named the new police commissioner, Danielle Outlaw, from Portland, Oregon, the first woman, the first African-American woman to head the department. We have a lot to talk about. And Mayor Kenney joins us on Radio Times, sitting across from me here in our Philadelphia studios. So nice to have you back on the show.
Good morning. It's nice to be back. Thanks.
Nice to have you back with us. And again, to join our conversation, as always, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Really, one of the most consequential decisions a mayor makes is selecting a police chief. Why did you pick Danielle Outlaw?
Well, she was the best and most qualified person that we interviewed. We did about 30 interviews and over a course of 4 months. And when I first sat with her, I was overwhelmed. I mean, she had it all. And I thought to myself, if anyone's going to outpace her, they're going to have to really be something special. She's extremely intelligent. She is definitely a professional police law enforcement person. She has an MBA from Pepperdine University and a degree from the University of San Francisco. She has 20 years experience in the Oakland Police Department, grew up in Oakland, and then had, I think, almost 3 years or so with Portland. She rose to deputy commissioner in Oakland and then went to Portland, and she's something. She really is.
How important is it she is a woman? An African-American woman and also an outsider.
And I think it's important that people understand we did not select her because she's a woman or an African-American woman. We selected her because she was the best candidate who happened to be a black woman, which was, you know, added benefit. She has a way about her that I think will resonate well with the community. I think that she talks about building bridges. She talks about policing doesn't have to be inhumane. Humanity and policing and humanity and safety can go hand in hand. And the fact that if the people in the community that you're trying to keep safe and protect, if they trust you and they know that you have their back and you're not there to harass them or to give them a hard time or be disrespectful to them, they will be more forthcoming and helpful in solving crime and making all of us safer, including the police officers safer, because the trust the people have in them will keep them safe.
How does she scale up from a city that had, I think, 877 police officers? Philadelphia has something like 6,600. Portland is the 25th largest city in the country. Philadelphia is the 6th largest city in the country. I mean, in certain ways, I guess policing is policing, but Philadelphia has its own culture.
Well, as she says, you know, policing is if you're doing it right, it's the same, you know, across the country, across the world. She was in Oakland for 20 years and was a deputy commissioner in Oakland, so I don't want to discount that the only thing she ever did was Portland. I mean, and Portland has its challenges, its homeless challenges, its public protests and things of that nature. And one of the things is both the left and the right in Portland complained about her sometimes. So if you're getting complaints from both sides, you're probably balanced in the middle. I just think that her approach, the way she speaks and how she engages people, I think, is really important in building those bridges. And she also did really well in Wheel of Fortune.
I know. Apparently she won Wheel of Fortune. It's just something we will ask her when we get her on Radio Times. There were complaints, though, in this city about how you handled this process, that it really wasn't open to public for public discussion or for public input. How come? Why didn't you want to hear from the public?
Danielle Outlaw said that if it was a transparent, open process where people knew she was looking for another job outside of Portland, she wouldn't have applied. These are personnel issues, and of the 30, we had 18 internal candidates, and the remainder were outside of town. So if you don't want your mayor or your city council to know you're looking for another job, a lot of people wouldn't have applied, including her. So, I mean, it's almost inherent that you have to do this in somewhat, you know, closed process. We can't also pick a police commissioner by having a town hall meeting and, you know, lining up candidates on the stage and asking them questions. That's not a good way to do that. And the other issue is if we made public who the selection committee was, then they would have gotten lobbied by the rest of the world on who they wanted for their candidate. So we just felt it was better to do it this way. I mean, I did get elected twice, and I think that people have put the faith in me to make those selections, and I'm happy with the selection. I really am. It's made me feel good to be able to do it.
But is there a question about buy-in? If people living in the city feel like, well, I didn't really have a chance to tell the mayor what I wanted, will there be a question about buy-in?
Well, they did
her?
Have a chance. There was 4,000 people responded to a questionnaire online about what they wanted to see in the police commissioner. I mean, I've lived in the city my whole life. I don't recall any public process to select any commissioner, whether it's police, fire, streets, whatever. So, I mean, I recognize that police commissioner is a different and more sensitive role, and it encompasses a lot of different problems that we're facing as a city. All cities do have that issue, but we felt that we did a comprehensive process that was 4 months long, a large number of candidates, and I know we had the best one.
Philadelphia has a rising rate of violent crime, of gun-related mm-hmm. crime. What did she tell you that gives you confidence that she can address this problem? And you've talked about reducing the homicide rate by 30%.
Yeah, well, we have to have goals. I mean, we have to set goals when we see something rising like this, or our poverty rate, trying to get 100,000 people out of poverty over the next 4 years. The issue is that there's three areas that affect violent crime and homicide. Poverty is absolutely number one. Number two is lack of educational opportunities and lack of training opportunities. And third is guns. Now, we've gotten more guns off the street through policing in the last couple of years than we've ever had. But the flow of guns are insatiable. I mean, they just won't stop. So the fact of getting reasonable gun control or anything like that from out of Washington or Harrisburg is not likely. So what we can control is how we address poverty, what we've done in investing in education, $1.2 billion in new money. Certainly we have this issue with our school buildings, which are they're 100 years old. I mean, but they're, you know, you can't snap your fingers and fix that problem, you know, in the course of a week. And then you really need to build that trust with the community, so that they will be willing to give you information, be willing to help you solve crime, be willing to look. There's a small number of people in this city doing bad things. The rest of the folks are held hostage in their neighborhoods by this small number of people. And as Danielle said to me, she said, you know, policing with a wide net doesn't work. More like spearfishing is how you want to approach it. You want to identify the people who you think are the who have been involved in this bad activity, are the most likely to shoot or be shot, and to concentrate your efforts on them, and not, you know, stop every young black male on the street and frisk them. I mean, that doesn't work, because all it does is engender anger and resistance to policing, to the police department.
But didn't Philadelphia have a focused deterrence program? It started a couple of years ago, and then it kind of disappeared.
Well, we're working with the DA to try to reinstate that. We have to tread lightly from a civil liberty standpoint, you know, identifying people and having them on a database. And, you know, the ACLU, God bless them, and I'm glad they're there. We'll monitor those kinds of things. We have to do it the right way. We need buy-in from both the DA and the police and the community. And we're looking to reinstate that again. I don't know why it stopped. It just seemed that I don't have an answer as to why it ended.
Even though you're mayor of Philadelphia?
No. But I think the DA was not a big fan of it when he came in. We're trying to get him back on kind of the same page that we're on. You need all those law enforcement agencies to work together in order to make it effective. And you can't just, again, cast a wide net and start pulling people in, you know, without any basis.
Let me ask you about some of the problems, some need for reform in the Philadelphia Police Department. A number of officers fired for racist and offensive Facebook comments. You've got the resignation of the former Commissioner Ross under a cloud because of a sexual harassment lawsuit. Former Inspector General Carl Holmes, charged with sexually assaulting three female officers, apparently got promotions in spite of his bad behavior. Apparently, this was well known in the department. 11 internal complaints, something like $1 million spent in settling a claim. Right. What can she do about this?
She is forceful and is and understands that this problem is pervasive within the police department and is one of her top priorities in getting it resolved. You know, this is not an excuse, but we are often hampered by arbitration and hampered by state law. There's lots of people I'd like to get rid of that we've tried to and. Just people get put back by the arbitration process. If we had some relief from Harrisburg on Act 111, Act 111 exists because police and firefighters can't strike, so they get arbitration. And often the arbitrator, defies common sense and puts that person back. So we're looking to get concessions in this contract coming up, which we are we're on the road to that now. We put in our final request. They put in their final request, and we'll start negotiating. And John McNesby
is head of the
FOP. He represents his members to the best of his ability, but he's not an unreasonable person. And we've been able to have some conversation about some of these things. And I think they recognize that we need to make some changes in order to affect a better department.
But can she do something that the previous commissioners were unable to do? And I remember interviews with several of them that I've done, and that was one of their complaints.
We're going to have to continue to work through the contract process, work through, hopefully, maybe get some changes in arbitration from Harrisburg. I don't think that's likely, but we're going to certainly pursue that. I do think that she has a couple fresh approaches to how we can deal with these issues.
Anything you want to share with us?
No, not this moment.
Here's a comment from Gwen. Outlaws a history of covering up police stops of people of color in Oakland and collaborating with Proud Boy protesters in Portland. How does the mayor respond to this past behavior?
As I said, she was criticized by both sides, by both the left and the right. So I think she comes down right in the middle. We asked that question about how you handle protests and the like, and the fact that department is smaller. They don't have a lot of bodies to deal with it. So they took some tactics that created some complaint.
Irritants and flash.
Yeah, but here we don't do that here because we have enough police and enough bicycles and enough bodies to continue to kind of move people or contain the protests. We have not had a lot of complaints about public protests and public events in the city.
So she will not be asking police officers to use irritants or flashbang devices.
No.
Okay. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney is our guest. Just began his second term as Philadelphia mayor this week after, it should say, an easy win in November. This is a very Democratic city. And you can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney, just sworn in for his second term. He's got a big agenda dealing with the city's growing rate of gun violence, the city's high rate of poverty, cleaning up the dirty streets, making city government more customer-friendly. Let me just read a couple of comments here or questions. One from Christian who says, what will the mayor do to make sure the police force doesn't treat people living with drug addiction like criminals? We need to treat this like a public health crisis.
Correct. We're doing more and more what we call warm handoffs, where a person's on the street, injecting drugs or, is drug addicted and doing crime that is de minimis as far as, it's not, assaulting anyone or that kind of stuff, that we don't arrest them generally. We take them to one of the places where they can seek treatment. They're not required to accept the treatment, but the warm handoff is an easier way for us to address that problem. We've been doing that in Kensington for quite some time now. We have our officers are specially trained, and they work with social workers and addiction specialists. One of the things I regret not doing sooner was taking the opioid crisis for the serious health issue that it is. I mean, we just didn't realize the extent of it. I mean, it's
even though it was. I mean, if you went to Kensington, there it was.
But it got worse. It got exponentially worse during the course of the time from my first year up until even the second year. When we cleared the encampment on the Gurney Street tracks, mm-hmm. which everybody wanted us to do, and we did so in a humane way and secure way, and it's cleaned up now, but those people were dispersed throughout the neighborhood. And then we had four encampments underneath the train trestles off of Allegheny Avenue. And we had to remove those encampments, but we had to do it in a way that was civil liberties were maintained. So we had to put signs up. We had to engage the folks on a regular basis. By this date, we're going to move this. By this date, here we have a bed for you here. We have a place for you to go here. We have drug treatment here. Some people would accept it. Some people wouldn't. And then we had to clear the encampments. We just cleared an encampment at 18th and Line.
Over the weekend, right?
Over the weekend. I mean, it's not something we enjoy doing, but people can't have people in camping, out in the open. We have one right down the street here that we're working on next, and also the Race Street around the Convention Center is also another problem that we're addressing. But as far as we try not to arrest people as much as we can. We closed the prison. We have 3,000 less people in jail than we did when I first started in office, and we closed the House of Correction. So we are all about prison reform and criminal justice reform, and we don't want to put people in the criminal system, and they are sick. It's like a disease, and we have ways and methods of trying to hand off people to the right folks.
How much do you think a safe injection site in Philadelphia would address that problem?
Well, we call it an overdose prevention site because semantics are so important. You know, safe injection sites. Our lawyers say no, we should use overdose prevention. Mm-hmm. Look, we have to keep people alive. They can't get better if they die, and if they're injecting in an alleyway, in a darkened street, or in some abandoned house, and they overdose, they're going to die, and we lose them. If we can, and I've been to the overdose prevention sites in Toronto and Vancouver. The Toronto one I think is better. Vancouver's a little more chaotic, but if we do it in the right way, we won't operate them. The city will not operate, but the city will provide wraparound services of addiction treatment and help with people's health and other types of counseling, and we'll be there on site, but we won't be running it. But I think the most important thing that a government can do is keep people alive, and the other thing we've been doing is working with the prescribers. I mean, a lot of this is created by bad docs and pharmaceutical companies that told people this stuff wasn't addictive, and doctors prescribing 6-7 times the normal amount of opioids. So we've been dealing with them. We've been dealing with the hospitals. I mean, I had surgery a number of years ago and walked out of the hospital and they handed me 30 oxycodones. I'm like, why do I need this? Why do I need this? I mean, I don't – give me Tylenol 800. I'll be fine. So it's that kind of education that we're working with. Our Commissioner Farley, our health commissioner, is doing a terrific job in engaging with the medical community and others to tamp down the amount that's being prescribed. And on the other side, we're trying to get people into treatment.
Adam emailed, why does the mayor think crime hasn't gone down in the last few years and what part of law enforcement is responsible for
that? Well, overall crime has gone down.
It's
shootings and homicide, which obviously are the top of the heap. I mean, when it comes to trying to fix it, but all the other crime that we record has actually gone down. Again, as I said earlier, it's poverty, education, lack of job training opportunities that we were fixing, and then the flow of guns. Right. I mean, that poor little girl, that 2-year-old, was shot in her house with an AK-47. There is no reason in the world why it's even manufactured why it's even allowed in this country. It's a military assault weapon. It belongs in the hands of the military. You know, heavy magazines with lots of bullets in them. There's no place in society for this. But I'm not going to convince the Trump administration or the state legislature in Pennsylvania to outlaw these things. So we're going to have to continue to work with what we have to do the best we can.
But you are handcuffed because of state law and even federal law.
I mean, yeah. As I said earlier, we've taken more guns off the street in the last year or two than we've ever taken off the street before. And we still have the flow of guns coming in. The other issue, frankly, is these gun shows. I mean, I could go to a gun show in the suburbs within, you know, 10 miles of Philadelphia, buy a bag of guns, no background check, no record, no anything, and I could sell them. And we've actually tracked, along with the Attorney General's office and ATF, have tracked people that go to gun shows, buy a bag of guns, and sell them in the parking lot to people or before they even leave. I mean, so if you can transfer guns, buy guns, transfer guns that easily, I mean, we can't get a law passed in Pennsylvania that will require you reporting your gun stolen. So what happens is, guy gets out of jail, he can't go buy a gun legally, so he gets a friend, a girlfriend, or somebody to buy the gun for him. He does something bad with the gun, it gets traced back to the buyer, and the buyer says, my house got burglarized, my car got broken into. And they don't have to report the gun stolen. So we can, if we got a little bit of help like that, we would be better off.
Well, let's go from crime in the streets to clean streets. Mm-hmm. And this has been a contentious issue here in Philadelphia.
Yep.
The idea of cleaning streets and moving cars so that street cleaners can go through. There was a pilot program that used leaf blowers.
Yeah, we're still doing it.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But came under a lot of criticism.
Some.
Because
people who
it's kind of like blowing litter around the street.
People who live on those streets were happy that the streets were cleaned. I mean, I understand environmentalists, and I am an environmentalist. I understand they were concerned about the, you know, the gas blowers, and
sure.
I got that. Look, here's
But you can do it in – I was up in Brooklyn. And
yes, you can do it. You can do it in Brooklyn.
Why can't – I mean, what has taken so long in Philadelphia?
Well, we used to have a street sweeping program in Philadelphia, and then the recession hit in 2008. And another administration understandably cut back on a lot of different areas, and that was one of the areas that cut back. So bringing it back was more a problem, a financial problem. But let's go to the basic. The trash does not fall from the sky. It doesn't rain trash. People have to have more respect for their city and for their community. I mean, when I was growing up in South Philly in the 1960s, if I dropped a piece of paper in the street in front of my mother, I'd get a smack in the back of the head and told me to pick it up. But I see adults standing at a bus stop, emptying out their pocketbook with the trash they don't want and throwing it in the street. I mean, and then we have the short dumping issue, where people decide it's okay to take the couch they don't want anymore, the mattress they don't want, and dump it in the parking lot or dump it in somebody's street. So we've instituted two detectives that work on short dumping who are prosecuting people for short dumping. We put up, you know, tons of cameras to catch people in the act. And then we started the pilot program, which some people have complained about, but we're going to continue that. We've decided that by 2023, we're going to have street sweeping in every neighborhood, mechanical broom, and not every neighborhood's the same. So, you know, certain parts of Northeast Philly, for example, people park their cars in their driveway. Certain parts of Mount Airy, you know, but in more congested areas, like South Philadelphia and other areas that are tightly congested with row houses, people are going to have to move their cars. Mm-hmm. Now,
where are they going to put them?
They're going to put them in a different parking spot, which is what
– do those exist?
You don't have to find one. I mean, but the point is that it's not easier to park in Manhattan than it is in Philadelphia. So if people in Manhattan can find a place to park their car one day a week for a couple hours, then we're going to have to follow suit. But I will tell you that Frank DiCicco, for example, who was the first district council person for a long time, is a clean freak. I mean, he just hates trash. So – he instituted this mechanical street sweeping program, and at some point in time, he stopped it because he thought he was going to lose his election because people in his district were complaining so badly about moving their car.
Was it a couple of loudmouths, or was it really his district?
No, it was a lot of people. I mean, I was in council at the time, and we would talk about this issue, and a lot of people complained. But I think Philadelphia has changed to a point where even in South Philly, it's not the South Philly that your grandmother knew. There's a lot of new residents living there, and a lot of people with a different attitude about kind of being a good citizen, a good public citizen, and will cooperate now than did before. And we're going to have to do it in order to get it clean. Again, the leaf blower thing people complain about, but it has made a difference, a positive difference, but we can't continue that way. We have to put the mechanical brooms out.
So no more filthy Delphia.
No more filthy Delphia if people who live here would stop trashing their streets. I mean, I see people out of their car window, and I'm going to get shot or something one day because I'm yelling at them to keep their trash in their car. When I drove my car myself, which I haven't done for 4 years, I hope I remember how to drive after 8 years, I would have a back seat or back seat floor full of trash because I would put my trash back there and then empty it when I went to get my car cleaned. So people have to be a little more cognizant of their responsibilities.
Are you going to act more like your mom then?
I'm not smacking people in the back of the head. No.
Okay,
she wouldn't smack me hard. Just a tap.
Yes. Okay. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney, our guest on Radio Times. He was sworn in yesterday for his second term. And again, it's a city with a lot of challenges/problems. And Jim Kenney telling us what he wants to do to make this a better place to live. You can join us and again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. This is the poorest large city in the country of the top 10 cities. It has been that way for really decades at this point. I think every mayor has tried to do something about it, well intentions. It's gone down, I think, a percentage point, but it's still about
percent and a half.
Percent and a half. But still, we're talking about 25% of the city
24.5.
are poor, and many of them are extremely poor.
Correct.
And I know you want to get 100,000 people out of poverty in the next decade. Right. How are you going to do that?
We're going to continue to fund education. I mean, the most important poverty buster there is education, and that's part of the reason why for years we were looking, nationally and statewide, with the exception of the governor and some others, look at education as some kind of luxury that people need to pay for as opposed to, you know, not providing it as a basic service. I mean, the beverage tax we passed, we've got 6,000 kids or so through, quality pre-K. We've put $1.2 billion, new money, Philadelphia money, in our school system. Our schools are showing some improvement in test scores. There are more quality schools than there were before we started. People are choosing. I mean, I had a guy I ran into as an engineer was transferred into Philadelphia, and he said, I just moved into South Philly. I said, why? He said, because I love the school. He said, the public school there is terrific, and that's why we chose that neighborhood.
You need more of them, though.
No, I know. That's what we're working on.
Right.
But doing that, the other issue is job training. For people who are not school age to be able to get a certificate, to be able to take a job. The jobs are out there. It's not that we don't have the jobs. We just don't have the talent pool to fill those jobs. And the other thing we're working on is trying to get make community college the linchpin of the adult education world, have our kids who are in high school be able to get dual enrollment both in college and in high school so they can get some credits before they graduate from high school, to get people who are returning from incarceration into programs that give them real skills so they can go to work. It's all about education, job training, and credentialing that really will make a difference in people being able to pull themselves out of poverty by having a job that allows them to do that.
Here's an email from Bernie. Mr. Mayor, you often proclaim the city lacks money to pay for its schools, yet you continue to give tens of millions of Philadelphia property taxpayer dollars to real estate developers who contribute money to your campaign and to campaigns of city council members through tax abatement. Let's talk about tax abatement. Does the city still need it?
Well, they just changed it.
They did.
There was a piece of legislation which I supported that changed the tax abatement. It ratchets down the tax abatement over a 10-year period. Look, I understand the view from people that tax abatement is unfair, especially if you're not getting one. It's extremely unfair to you. But the development that we've seen in the city over the past 20 years is primarily because of the tax abatement. And I recognize that people say, well, this multimillionaire buying a multimillion-dollar condo or you know, whatever house doesn't deserve a tax abatement. You're correct, they don't, but they don't have to live here. They can decide to live in Radnor or in Cherry Hill or someplace else. They chose Philadelphia because it's affordable and because they can get an incentive that brings them here. And when they come here, those very rich people, and I need more of them, because they contribute to the economy, they pay taxes, they shop, they go out, they do things that, you know, poor people can't do, and we get a lot of money there. In many cases, a couple years of their taxes pay their tax abatement. But we understood the optics.
You can understand why people see it's unfair.
I can understand the optics, right. but the fact of the matter is that if we eliminated the tax abatement today, not one new dollar would flow to the school district. We have to have development. We have to have people working in development, and we have to balance that. But we put $1.2 billion in new dollars in the school district in the last 4 years. So, I mean, we're not starving the district. We're trying to catch up to where we were when all the cuts were made.
How do you, though, propose to both welcome gentrification? It sounds like you support the idea of bringing people of means into the city, but without either pushing out residents who are lower income and maybe have been part of a community for decades, if not generations.
Yeah, there are a number of programs that we've instituted over the years. So, you know, the Homestead Act, where you can get reimbursement on your tax, senior citizen tax freeze, the long-term owner occupant program, the LOOP program, where if your assessment goes up by a certain percentage, the higher percentage is forgiven for 10 years. It's their version of 10-year tax abatement. People have to sign up for those. And we try to encourage people through district council, people through the libraries, for people to know that these programs exist and to sign up for them. We have to provide, and we're doing that now, money for more affordable housing development. We've taken the money that's coming in now from properties going off the abatement rolls, coming back onto the rolls. The school district's getting their portion, but the city's portion is going into a housing trust fund. To build affordable housing for folks so we can stabilize neighborhoods and keep people in their neighborhoods that they grew up in or generationally grew up in. So we don't want to see people pushed out, but we want to see new folks moving in. New younger families are moving into the city. So we're continuing to improve our schools, kind of provide a better quality of life for everyone, and attract more people to the city.
You mentioned community college, and we're almost up in a break here. Jake asks, what is Mayor Kenney's vision for Community College of Philadelphia? I mean, it seems like you're saying let's connect it to the schools.
My aspirational vision for community college, free, no tuition. I mean, that's our aspirational goal, and we're working on through in this budget and a way to provide dollars for kids who just can't make that last tuition payment or make the full tuition payment or have, you know, housing issues or food insecurity issues. I mean, a lot of college kids are really struggling.
Yes, they are.
And both with college debt that they've accumulated and being able to access higher education because they can't afford to, and there's no parent or relative to pay for it. So we're working with community college very closely, both from an admission standpoint and also from a quality programs where people can get credentialed to get jobs.
And that's Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney, our guest on Radio Times today. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney. He released a list of accomplishments from his first term in office. It was a report just released recently. And I'll just summarize a couple of things: define the beverage industry with a soda tax, to fund quality pre-K and other programs, taking back local control of the city's public school system, investing in policies aimed at reducing the high rate of poverty, a more human-centered approach to the opioid epidemic, supporting affordable housing, being a sanctuary city in defiance of the Trump administration. And again, you can join our conversation. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just ask you a question about the Democratic Party in Philadelphia. You've got Kendra Brooks, who is now on city council. She's from the Working Families Party. Bob Brady, who said he's in charge of Philadelphia politics, fought against her candidacy, and he lost. John Dougherty is under federal indictment. Ed Rendell said with Krasner's win, and Ed Rendell was the mayor of the city, was a bad day for the Democratic machine. You've got State Representative Movita Johnson-Harrell, who was charged with theft and perjury, stealing from a nonprofit that she founded. I mean, this all reflects very badly on the Democratic Party. What's wrong here?
Well, I think if you look around the country, you're going to find people who do misdeeds on both parties. Happens to be that this is a highly Democratic registration city. So those who run afoul of – and again, you know, some of these folks have not been adjudicated anything yet. You know, there's accusations from the government, and you know, we'll see how everything rolls out. But, I mean, because we're such a highly dense Democratic party – a Democratic registration here, the people get in trouble tend to be Democrats.
Right.
If you go to Florida or someplace else where or Texas, I'm sure there's lots of Republicans who also run afoul of the law and do you know misdeeds, you know, based on their party's affiliation. So I mean, I think it's more has to do with the number of Democrats in the city than it has to do with Democrats being evil and Republicans not.
I mean, are you corrupt and contented? That has been a description.
No, not at
of
all. I mean, we have the U.S. Attorney's Office is going to do what they're going to do, and right. and we respect them and we respect the work that they do, and we'll see how things turn. We'll see how things turn out. But I think the city's changing, so the party's going to change. And what you see in South Philadelphia, for example, in the first and second wards in Philly, second ward was run by Buddy Cianfrani, and the first ward was run by Jimmy Tayun. And I knew them both. I've been around that long. If you see what's happening there now, you have younger, more progressive people who are signing up to be committee people and running for office themselves down there, and ward leaders that are progressive and that, you know, care about issues as opposed to, you know, political muscle or political power, and I think the city will change that way for the good. I think that Brady has done a decent job, good job in the term that he's been there, but I think times change, and I think times change for the better, and you'll see different players, different people, and I think that's a good thing for the party.
Time for him to step aside?
No, I mean, that's up to the Democratic committee people and the ward leaders, and at some point in time, things change, and you have elections, and people's the heads of organizations change because there's elections, and that's a good thing.
I mentioned the beverage tax. This was one of your signature pieces of legislation for your first term. It's a 1.5% per ounce tax on sodas, including sugarless sodas.
Well, diet.
Diet sodas. Yeah. It is unpopular.
I got a big hand yesterday in my inauguration speech about the beverage tax.
Okay.
I think that the beverage industry has put millions and millions of dollars into advertising to twist this issue towards their view, and that's fine for them to do that. But the stores aren't closing, people aren't losing their jobs. I mean, think about this: we're having this big debate about soda. I mean, of all the things that are affecting the city, state, and country, soda. I mean, and it's providing.
People drink a lot of soda.
It's for providing resources, and I drink some. I don't drink a lot. I don't drink as much, but I still buy it in Philly because I want to support pre-K and community schools. I mean, the trade-off is that we have kids that are being educated and getting ready for school that will be productive citizens when they matriculate through high school and college, based on 1.5 cents on a soda. I mean, if that's the most important thing in your life, then I feel sorry for you.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. Looks like we've got Patrick, and Patrick calling us from Kensington. Patrick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi there, Patrick. Oop, I don't think he's there, but he wanted to know, why does Philly still arrest African-Americans for cannabis use when it is decriminalized?
I'm not aware of large amounts of arrests. There may be other issues when someone gets arrested in possession, but I passed the bill. I introduced the bill to decriminalize small possession of marijuana. I don't know about specific cases. Mm-hmm. I mean, there may have been other reasons why the person was arrested, but on an overall basis, they're not supposed to arrest people for possession of cannabis under an ounce.
An email from Ben, is there ever going to be a reduction in the city wage tax? I'm a social worker who makes less than $40,000 a year. The city wage tax takes, he says, about 20% of my paycheck. It makes it difficult to have money for extra expenses.
City wage tax has gone down every year since Ed Rendell. Now, they're not big slashes because we can't, if we big slash the wage tax, we're going to have a lot of service cuts and people are not going to like them either. But we've, with the exception of the recession, where Mayor Nutter froze he didn't increase the tax, but froze the reduction. Since, I guess 98, 99, there's been an annual reduction in the wage tax every single year since then, with the exception of the recession freeze. And we'll continue doing that. If we can accelerate it, we will. But it's going in the right direction.
He says the city wage tax takes about 20% out of my paycheck. It's really closer to what is the city wage tax?
It's less
than 5%.
Oh, it's way less than 5%. It's three. I don't know. I mean, it's 3 point whatever. I mean,
okay, it's not 20%.
No.
Okay, let me try the phones again. We got Dan calling us from Philadelphia. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, there, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was talking back to the litter issue, and it kind of bugs me when people are demonized for the littering issue. And I grew up in Baltimore, live in Philly now for the past 5 years. And in Baltimore, there's no litter on the streets, but there's also a public trash can on every corner. And so I think having somewhere to put the trash would help with it not ending up on the ground.
Well, we do have public trash cans around areas of the city. For example, on South Broad Street, there are those big belly trash cans. But here's what happens. And this is I'm not demonizing people. I'm just saying what people do. There's a lot of apartments on Broad Street. People, for some reason, have a need to have to take their trash out every single night and put it in the public trash can, which means by the end of the week, the trash can is overflowing and trash is all over the place. And now people start putting their trash bags next to the overflowed trash can, and it looks just as bad. If people would follow the rules and use the trash can just for their litter in their hand, as opposed to their bag of their little goodie bag of trash every night, we would be able to maintain the trash cans better. In some areas, we've taken them out because people just use it as a short dump. So trash day's on a Friday. Tuesday night, they're putting their trash out next to the trash can. I mean, it's that kind of behavior that people need to think about in order to have clean streets.
But, I mean, this is such a basic question, but Dan just says if you had more trash cans on every street corner, you could help solve this problem.
Absolutely, but also you can keep your trash in your bag or in your mm-hmm. You don't need to you can wait till you get home to put your trash in the trash can, or you can keep it in your car until you clean your car. There's this need to kind of get rid of things. But standing at a bus stop, emptying your bag and dropping your stuff on the ground, to me it's ridiculous. And then complain about the fact that the city's dirty.
Well, I guess going from trash to things like recycling, investing in climate change goals. We've got a president who pulled us out of the Paris Accord and is lifting environmental regulations. What can Philadelphia do to counterbalance that?
Philadelphia is doing it. We're abiding by the Paris Accords. We're taking care of all our buildings, making sure they're energy efficient. We've done energy audits on all the buildings the city owns. We've incentivized people's residential and commercial reliance on energy saving methods, green roofs and the like, solar. We've done the largest solar deal ever in Pennsylvania, where I think 70% of our 70% of our energy needs will be covered by this solar farm. That's
by
out.
When?
I believe.
Uh-huh.
We're doing our end. We understand that the city has a big carbon footprint, and we can have a real effect on climate change and on the environment. And we're moving more vehicles to electric vehicles. We're working with SEPTA to convert their fleet to electric. We're doing everything within our financial capacity to have a positive impact on the environment. We believe in it. I mean, recycling's been difficult because the market for recyclables is way down. China's refusing to take – and the other issue here is people sometimes don't understand what recycles and what doesn't. So that pizza box
is not
recyclable. You know, containers with food waste that are not recyclable. And, you know, you wind up having to sort that stuff out, and then it costs you money to sort it out. And we have some recycle companies who won't take it anymore. I mean, I live in a building at Third and Race, and our private trash hauler won't take recyclables anymore that are contaminated with food waste. Mm. So,
some cities have put in a congestion tax to try to deal with the clogged streets, especially in Center City, Philadelphia.
You thought the beverage tax was bad, huh?
Yeah, but you know, getting around the city, now some of it is because of construction and streets under repair, but nonetheless, getting around the city is getting harder and harder.
I will tell you that as an observer, one of the things that has really mangled our congestion situation is Uber and Lyft. I love the convenience. I think it's – well, I did when I didn't ride with the police all the time. I love the convenience, and I understand it's an interesting industry, and it gives people the opportunity to – just pull to the curb, please. I mean, find a parking space while you're waiting for your customer. My understanding is the rules on Uber and Lyft is wherever that person says they want to be picked up, regardless of whether there's a place to pull over, they just stop. And it creates – anytime you have to – people double park. And that will block up Chestnut Street or block up any street for blocks because this one Uber or Lyft guy is sitting waiting for a customer.
Would a congestion tax, though, fix that, address that?
I don't – we have not researched it. I know London is doing it, and I don't know for at that point yet. I think certain parts of Manhattan are doing it. Here's the other issue. One of the other congestion problems, which just drives me crazy, is people block the box. They can't stop. You go to 15th and 15th around City Hall, right outside the Municipal Services Building. People cannot just wait at the intersection when the other side of the intersection's clogged. They need to get their car into the middle, and then it blocks up everything. So we've put more traffic police out there at rush hour to try to get people to stop their car before they get into the intersection. But a lot of it's kind of common sense stuff. Mm. Congestion tax may be a possibility, but it's not on our radar right now.
I mean, it seems that you're like our mother trying to get us to behave, behave.
Well, I tell you what, I'll give you a good example. I went to London. I went to London, first time I was ever there. They follow rules. I mean, public transportation there, if you know you got to be on the right side of the escalator in the tube, because I was traveling with people who were standing on the left side. I'm pulling them over to the right side, but the system works. No one jumps the fares. You know, everybody accommodates each other. People let you cross the street when they're in a car. It's a different kind of mindset. I mean, I've seen old ladies almost run over by some guy who wants to make a left-hand turn, and he's too impatient to wait for the woman to cross the street.
Let me play a clip. And this, you were speaking with our own Tommy McDonald following your electoral victory. This, was, of course, in November when you won re-election. Let me just play. It's a very short clip coming from an interview that Tom McDonald did with you.
There are one or two spots that I would consider going for, and one is governor and the other is U.S. Senate.
There was some question about whether you were referring to 2022 or 2024.
I mean, look, I'm mayor now. I just got sworn in yesterday. I intend to be mayor till the end of the term, but you always look at other possibilities. I mean, I'm not that old yet. I mean, I'm 61. And you look at opportunities that may arise. I'm not saying it's definitely going to happen. I intend to do my job the best of my ability till my term is up, and we'll see what happens going forward.
But, I mean, just based on what you just said there, so if an opportunity of running for governor or U.S. Senate were to arise, you would consider it?
I would say you'd be a fool not to consider it. One of the things I think about the state, and I think I admire Governor Wolf for this, is he's really tried to fund education. I mean, if you look at Pennsylvania, it's one of the highest states, the highest tuition states in the country. I mean, I know families have sent their kid to Alabama to go to school at Crimson Tide because it was cheaper as a non-resident than to go to Penn State. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if we really want to be serious about making Pennsylvania competitive, then our education needs to be funded, as they do in southern states. Georgia and Alabama fund education, public education, better than we do. So that's the only reason I would think about something like that. But I have no intention. My intention is to finish my term.
Almost out of time here. What can you do or what do you want to do as mayor to defeat Donald Trump?
I'm for Elizabeth Warren. I endorsed her already. I know Bloomberg got in late, so he's making some strides. I mean, as we get closer to Super Tuesday, I think we'll see, you know, who it fleshing out. I'm concerned about Trump getting reelected. I really am. I think that his method of campaigning is misdirection. And I mean, this whole thing now with this assassination of this general, I mean, I think this is all a diversion. This is all, let's do something. So, you know, look this way and not look at my impeachment. I think he's been the most corrupt president in the country's history, without a doubt. And I think that all the people around him are corrupt. I think his family benefits from him being in office. I think the whole thing is just it's just disgusting. And on top of that, He's a rude person. I mean, he's not presidential, and people for some reason or another are attracted to that. And I don't understand the mindset.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, okay. Mayor Jim Kenney. Thank you very much.
Thanks
for joining us on Radio Times.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for those calls and those questions and those comments.